from her home in Northern Ireland. This event is part of a statewide festival called Arizona Salutes British Arts. We're a bit more sanguine about that association since there has been a peace in Northern Ireland since we planned this reading. Maeve McGuckian was born in Belfast, where she now lives with her husband and four children. She received a BA and MA degrees from Queen's University in Belfast, where she was also the first woman to be named writer in residence. She's the author of four books of poetry, The Flower Master, Venus in the Rain, On Ballycastle Beach, and most recently, Marconi's Cottage. In a recent review that was published in the New Yorker, her work was compared to both Emily Dickinson and John Ashbery. An odd fusion of influences, one might think. I scratched my head many times and went back and back to her poems and finally said yes. McGuckian's poems do share the immediate and shape-shifting energy of Ashbery, along with the quirky interior sense of spiritual urgency one finds in Emily Dickinson. It's truly an honor to have her with us. Please welcome Maeve McGuckian.
After many vicissitudes, I love that word, I'm here, and I'm very happy to be here. Believe me, I'm very happy to be here. I hope we are celebrating the peace, and I begin with some of our early poems, which for some reason, being in Arizona, this a couple of early poems I had seemed to fit with the landscape that I'm suddenly plunged into, very amazing moonscape of a landscape that I'm in, and it's very much more beautiful than I had imagined here. So this is a poem I wrote a long time ago, and the kind of vegetation in it, and stage managing going on in the poem reminds me just of being here in Arizona. So don't worry about what it means. You know, just accept that it's probably something to do with sex, but you can work it out as you go along. Anyway, really, it's just about my inner world, and this was how I felt. So it's called Story County, and I'm dedicating it to the state of Arizona. Loose strife will not soothe the thirst of tall grass, migrating with the luminous speed. The gay feather adds to the Indian pony, the serried steps of the sidewinder, the flavor of the garter snake. Its early blush is green and warm. It coarsens with the summer till the cows are lost like the toad's voice, or the crocodile in the jaws of family life, the smoke screen of religion. The meadowlarks sing in the spurs of prairie roses. Wine red fields of blue stem do what the wind says. Like a mermaid wheelchair, I manicure demurely stone houses, rock maples, timber birds. The wooden country soil is a varnished sheen. I'm dumb with pumping water in Story County, breeding tangle legs and self-heal, hawkweed and bluets, also known as Quaker's Lady's Innocence. Totally opposite to go back to my own country and to go back into Ireland and give you some idea of Ireland's history. And we were talking last night about hot toddies, and actually drinking, some people were drinking hot toddies. So this is a poem dedicated to the hot toddy, I suppose, and to all that side of things. So it's an Irish poem, and it's called The Cure, which is a euphemism for whiskey. And boy, could you do with it sometimes. So it's called The Cure. And it's, again, it's an early poem, so you must forgive some of the extravagances. What is more beautiful than potatoes in bloom? A redhead swinging potsheen from her breasts. A smuggler from the cradle with no character to lose. She gives no dry bargains. She's the dough in the still. Grain sprouts under the bed, steeps in the false gable, to keep Red Willie's tongue as rough as corduroy. It would make a rabbit spit at a dog to see it swallowed by hat makers and French polishers. Once a man gets land, he loses his thirst. They should have been canonized who sprayed water on the worm, vapor kettle's nipple. In the Diocese of Derry, it's a reserved sin. Speaking of sin, what do we see? Do we ever speak of anything else, I wonder? I've been talking about sin all day today. This is one dedicated to Trevor Weeks, who was my host last night, and very genial. And it's about stargazing, and he's an astronomer, and it really was dedicated originally to my sister, who also is an astronomer. So it's called Magazines, and again, as with a lot of my poems, the titles would play on the two meanings of that, because magazines is, you know, glossy magazines, fashion magazines, but also powder kegs or building up of explosives, which was what was happening in the country at the time. It was a very explosive situation. So it's a very explosive poem, really. Magazines. The sun is quiet. It's so dark, the women in their houses keep the lights on all day, their heated germs unwinding. They do not worry about water running out in the fringes of their appley beds. They are deep sky observing with their eye cups, dew caps, curved spiders, the software of cosmic time. In the hall, a bronze sculpture of Saturn, sunrise taken at the moon's straight wall, glossy blow-ups of a lunar earthrise, a talkative Martian sunset, while this week's star atlas muscles Charon in as Pluto's hanging plant, scrapbooks pile with jetty slides, the powder room at the country and western dance. And finally, from this early bunch, an Indian poem. We went to an Indian reservation yesterday, and I was very moved by the poverty and the beauty of it. And this is just a, it's sort of a pastiche of Paul Muldoon, who's always nattering on about Indians in a very patronizing way. I don't repeat that, but this is equally patronizing. But this is the woman, and it's again, I suppose, about sexuality, but it has a double-edged title again, because it's called Pemmican, which is the paste or the cakes that Indians, it's the name of Indian food, but it's also an emergency food supply, which again, at the time, there was all sorts of strikes and goings on in our country, and people were constantly filling their cupboards with tinned foods for the strikes that were, you know, I mean, I just remember doing that. And people were even doing that last, you know, when the ceasefire happened, the Protestants were going out filling their cupboards with tinned, you know, food, like for the nuclear war that was going to happen. And So as a result, the people lived off these tinned foods for a long time. So anyway, the title called Pemmican, and it's just a tribute to being here. They know nothing about the place, really, you know. But neither does Paul. Anyway, the buffalo in rut is edible. His skin will make a firewood boat across the Mussel Shell River. The locusts feed on the Artemisia shrubs. The ravens on little distant bear, dreaming in the cherry tree. We are his red-tipped osiers. His special one with the feather tuft wears white cosmetics, wormwood on her fingers. In the bison dance, we swing claw necklaces and eagle fans, the hourglasses meeting on our blankets. And this book is all about flowers. It was supposed to be all about flowers, but again, it was about something else as well. And I'll just read one longish poem in it, which is all about flowers. Just different kinds of flowers and different kinds of moods and different kinds of states and everything else. So it's in four sections and called The Orchid House. And part one. A flower's fragrance is a woman's virtue. So I tell them underground in pairs or in their fleshy white sleeves how desirable their shapes. How one was lost for 60 years with all its arching spikes, its honeyed tessellations, and how in bloom they will resemble moths, the gloss of mirrors, Christmas stars, their helmets blushing red-brown when they marry. And part two. In my alpine house, the slavery I pay my willful gentians, exploring all their pleats and tucks, as though they had something precious deep inside, that beard of camel hair in the throat. Touch them, ease their heads so slowly through their thumbhole necklines, till they sit like tailors in their earth shoes, their watery husband's knots. No insects visit them, nor do their ovaries swell. Yet every night in Tibet their seeds are membraned by the snow, their roots are bathed by the passage of meltwater. They tease, like sullen spinsters, the dewfall of summer limes. 3. The disdain of green summer cloud on our glasshouses has bred out the tomato's coat of hair, and flowers yield themselves less foolishly than deer that fan their cologne with the affluence of flattened tears. They must be harvested at dawn before their permafrost has sunk beyond a skater's melted world. Rude as hyacinths circling a private room at night, to this tall icicle, my geranium oil, the spills of my patchouli'd shawl. And the last one. The begonia's soil is rich and wet. I tuck it in around her as I would pat my hair, straightening her tubered root. We keep our sources secret. She swells with lymph and electricity, her fibers transparently taped up, and I sprout willowy as any sweet begonia. The last book was a kind of a preparation for death and a preparation for birth. It sometimes I think is not, they're not that distinguishable. And an early poem in this, my father had been ill for some time, and it seems as if I was ill also. I mean, he couldn't be ill without me being ill. And so the sicker he got, the sicker I got, of course. You know, he had to sort of look after me far more than he was able to look after himself, and I never bothered looking after him, of course. So anyway, this is about my father's illness, and it's an early poem trying to come to terms with the idea of losing him, never mind the fact of it. So it's called The Invalid's Echo. It was as if he put a thermometer back in its holder without shaking it, or snatched a cigarette out of my mouth like a secret breath. The way he put his finger on the rest, and we were disconnected. The thinnest paper was an unblue that had summoned him. It took 5 calls, sitting behind a desk, waking him prematurely as a parent poem out of an unfrightened 10-year stretch of love for 20 minutes by an open window. His foliage was unlike that of any other. His sound was like nothing else. My ears were never rested. I would have spent the rest of my life felling his timber, never taking my eyes off him, always looking straight at his mouth, if that was how he liked it. He practices at death with each embrace, in the language of our grandmothers, who spoke God's name continually, forgotten by our own free will. He says a prayer for the dying, over himself and me. His endearments execute the house's deepest reds. A house heals easily. Blood shed in the past loses its hue. If I could die the same death in the same air as him, I would wish my grave untended to, like everybody else's. Like the bulb that has not been washed since the revolution, the hole in the ceiling that has left a little pile of plaster on the floor. I think his family is so ancient, his heart must still be over on the right, though I have searched for it before in full swing until it shrank to nothing, merging with my name that comes from nowhere and is ownerless like all we can see of the stars. Now, like them, I lie with my back him, his chance neighbor, watching the entrance to the house, but not the house. The long autumn has scattered its poisonous seeds, so I will have no October child. By the time I have the dream that he will seek the word with his fingers, the word that can scarcely be used, that having forgotten everything, he will imagine the sky in its second appearance as the quintessence of blue, I will be freezing in my short jacket. In my last dream, it was after January, I was buying food for him when a truck I have lost track of came rattling into the over-fulfilled courtyard. And to balance that, one must always balance these things. One about my mother. I've never written a half-decent poem about my mother because I don't know. It's just one of those things. But this one is a jealousy poem and lots of Freudian things in it. But it's called Flowered Sitting Room, and I dedicated it to Anne Weeks, who we cheered ourselves up immensely talking about our mothers for the last couple of days. So it's dedicated to Anne and to her mother. And both of our mothers are in this situation. They probably had these very dynamic husbands who wore themselves out and abandoned them early on. So they're left with memories and they're left sitting in a room. But the room is their world, really. And it was particularly my father's world because my mother had him totally under her thumb. And she would say, now, redecorate this room for me. And the room would be redecorated every year, and it always looked exactly the same. But my father would have to spend, you know, days and days staggering up and down, and a labor of love for her. And you know, now that he's not there, the room hasn't been decorated. But so it's a poem called Flowered Sitting Room, and the flowered sitting room is, my mother is a flowered sitting room as far as I'm concerned. And more like a sitting bull, you know. Sorry. Okay. Anyway. So, tribute to my mother here. Okay. No, it is quite sweet, you know, just an attempt at sweetness. Anyway. Your low-roofed, half-kitchen, half-parlor, old type of motherhood loses the sun. 2 fields from the house, your snow-white companion, mourning, makes the land more silent than if we had never heard of him. You touch one of his bitten apples with your lips not soft, almost without thinking of the first signs of winter breaking up. In your heart's heart, this is your world for the moment. Daily before your eyes, for 3 short, long months, a flower that looks thick, round, and double faces a gradual death. But what is your experience of the flower, if not a vision so absolutely untransferable, that when early summer, now our newest neighbor, colors his evening kiss with your resting place, you see in him the impersonation of them. So I'll go on to some more recent poems. And this is one, my father had been dead a year when I wrote this. And it's a kind of reminiscence of his birth, of his death. And it's not as harrowing as the other one that I was going to read. So, and I don't think I can read the other one. So this is one that's where I'd sort of come to terms with it. So it, I hope it's not as depressing as it sounds. It's called The Nearness of the Grape Arbor to the Fruit Cellar. I better say that again so you can think about it. The Nearness of the Grape Arbor to the Fruit Cellar. That's C-E-L-L-A-R. Like an open prayer book against a body, 2 roads cross exactly on that corner. So it seems like an end, but is not, as marriage is not. He was not a country, but the material out of which countries are made. He was lying in long, loose waves of broken land. I had never seen any blood so bright, so frozen, hard enough not to smell. The gash was torn from inside outward. He felt his way through lilacs, trickling them through his fingers, as if he were separating hair, its mere shadings in grass. His features might have been cut out of a shell, they were so transparent. His chest, like a young blacksmith's, arched his shoulders, now brown and in seed. So the country seemed to lift itself up to me and come very near, with the dried stalks, the dead stand of last year. His hands burned red, looked calm, but blazed with the things he could not say, the other side of the pattern that is supposed not to count. His earth owl eyes warmed the guttered slope of my back with their swift fires. Such vivid pictures, they might have been his memories, but promised new things for living people. A silence seemed to ooze out of the ground. He coupled his mellow thunder to it, as a workhorse to its yoke mate, as if he knew it was to piece him out and make a whole creature of him. So with a pull that brought curling muscles to the smooth, sun-warmed hips of the horses. He cut his body from the pool of field dust that's scarcely larger than the bed that held him, a sleeve hanging empty, a good tight box that would turn water. Yet never scattered his beads, nor raised his hands except to cross himself, till I was left alone with the older voice of a winter which lies too long, has overslept, or early awakened, enjoys the deepening grey. This one is a strange poem about him. As the mourning period continued, I began to see him in all sorts of strange guises and wonder who he was and where he was, and had he been already reborn as a woman, and all this type of thing. And my mind was sort of off at certain tangents. And I was asked to write a poem for International Women's Day, and I felt I should write about a woman, but I still wanted to write about my father. So I ended up thinking about all those possibilities. And it's called Black Virgin, because I was thinking of the Virgin, the Black Virgin, which is sacred in Spain and probably around here as well. So I've tried to visualize this new identity of him. Probably again a totally crazy poem. Anyway, it's called Black Virgin. See, Black Virgin, being in love with you is a fine space. I will never live in your searching wash, your grass wallpaper, your bewildered red gardens. You desire your whole your virginity to be admired by angels only. Such dry self-knowledge, such sheer Englishness. How could I have mistaken you for my father? For the old days when there used to be people. Your days have a medieval structure. Your brief Cistercian night with its night office has fought sleep always. For morning, you touch your lower eyelid, deep awake, healthy and wise and quiet, with your eyes clear. What do you do with your eyes? With your womb, already primed, with its fern-like pattern, chaste berry, chaste tree, monk's pepper. If you are a woman, there's no question of a word like me being able to comprehend the voice that uttered it, or its sign language lordly and off balance with the inwardness of war. Perhaps I am a sound born with you and finished with you, your Lenten stomach, in a year when Easter was as late as it could possibly be. Or perhaps I am a military railway to you, another city with transient miles of criminals. But when rain arrives on the far side of emptiness, like an identity scarcely dreamed, and surrounds you with its unintelligible silence, its enormously comforting speech, even if it's talking to itself, as long as it talks, I will listen. Then it was a very, very difficult year last year, and I'd been accused of all sorts of subterfuges and by various people that I didn't take account of the troubles enough, and believe me, I did, only too much. But I began to write slightly more explicitly. It seemed as if it was becoming safer to say what you meant about things. So you will realize these are much more explicit as we go on. I wrote this poem. It's about it's called The Radio Trader. Who was Lord Haw Haw in the last war, who was Irish and was hanged by the British for giving information to the Germans. But in Ireland, he was sort of considered a hero. So he just seemed an image of the kind of complexity of loyalties that that you felt during that period, during the whole thing, that you were British and you were Irish and you were European and you weren't sure where you belonged. So it's about the notion of betrayal and the notion of cruelty and the notion of one lot being murderers and the other lot being policemen. So the radio traitor. Last year's honey, ill-preserved, bitter beyond all sweetening, is set down at another point in aridity, but drawn here by your longing. One of time's gables runs back to simplicity in your jessamined window. Because you offended the root of the law, your halls, stairs, and passages are in perpetual dusk. Because you rejoiced in the thought of the English dead lying under the west wall, you were always treated as British, whether you were or not. Men and men and men crowd at a stretch of water, washing their clothes, with vague faces, with defined bodies, different phases of the same man. You open and shut your breast, the rudiments of musketry, bayonet fighting, squad drill. Blood leaves your hands, your feet, your limbs, and flows back to your heart like a cold change in the room. Waking opposite your neck fires, my pushed mind slept. You stepped faster than spring, defeating that love that swears itself undying, taking the sky's enamel work with you, being pearly above where the rain falls. And this was when the declaration came out in December, and it was an absolute breakthrough in psychological terms. And it was the first thing that happened that seemed to be in any way in any kind of move to stop. Well, it seemed to me that the politicians and everyone else had just were just allowing people to be killed over and over and over and doing and didn't care. So the declaration that came out was a wonderful day. It was we all just sat glued to the television and it felt just like a total change, even though it took another 9 months to make any difference. So I wrote this poem to celebrate that early moment. The sky is called to make two bridges necessary. They were building this new bridge over the Lagan at the time. So it's called to make two bridges necessary. The sky is all fresh horses and unusual tidiness, jets of yellow and lavender marriages, with a twist of pink silk where its empire runs down, all brilliance, all morality, all tarry browns. Now its flecked beige vault holds a seagull, ready to leave like a hatchet beside a bed, a pencil scratch folded from the day before, open with the lean colour of our sleeping last night. I already wear all that you have imagined, your knee arched like a blizzard anchoring my chest, or a swollen river bridge conveniently looping into its street clothes out from music again. The sand between tides will thank you for fielding freedom with the quick of your hand and the crux of your ear, that memory plus moisture in the air, more unawakened, fireless lips, unlevied hair. This one's called Blue Doctrine. Not quite sure. It's just again around the same time when everything was very, very touch and go, and everything could have been gone in the direction of havoc or harmony. So it's called Blue Doctrine. The boundary of the light will not coincide with the edge of the window. With me by his side, he's not compelled to think about me, nor would he care whether my lips were more or less red. I feel like breaking the enchantment with a fierce shout, rendering needless the deception of colour, or writing each sentence in a different colour, so it resembles a little flag, having for background a half sun. For those who sit in the darkened doorways of their dwellings devoid of doors, the adding sound of bells can mean whatever you want it to, mobilization, a warlike tempo, passive defense. Over my head, a bat unfolds its wings like hands that seem to seek each other's warmth, or an eyelid opened in the pulse of a glove, as in the coat of arms of my native city. The air of the first night of summer, not a moment too early, not a moment too late, leaps into my paper bed in the uniform of sleep from the waist down, first a long stretch, then mistakes, then jumping by tens, until his stomach is tight against my thighs, ending in a row of notes, as if he had been with a woman. And this was one about a flight to Canada and coming home again, how everything again was still very uncertain, and you didn't know whether to celebrate or, stock up your tins. So it's called, again, they're rather strange titles and strange, any stranger than any others, but to me even, they even seem strange to me. This one has an amazing title. I love the title. It's called Shoulder-Length Caged Parrot Earrings, which, you know, were all the rage last summer, especially among the men. Okay. Female eyes, male hand, head full of closed sky. Your throat is still open, though your blood is being dried. The clock you started up in me leaves the plainest roses barely aged. You play a secret set of muscles, tip a rifle to your cheek, your nights billow no more than truces swimming towards daylight. How lightly, then, your rich body weighed. Tonight it weighs even less. Low-flying as meadow-coloured lead, overflying the white ruin of waves, their feeble climaxes sucking spring from the ground, a nude beach whose skin rings out like an angelus in foliage. Instead of my communion watch, I read the hour in the stubble of your beard, and now begin to live like a two faithful people whose last conquered hamlet has ceased signalling. Bastille Day weather covers me like waltzing one-horse towns caught in ice or seeds in mad acceleration, Europe-bound. Your arms are a living robe of earth you have with me, so death is a quarantine, only a death. You hold me like an unlit cigarette while you burn match after match and offer yourself in vain. You run star-splashed over the rust which would have gushed through your hands. 6 months obscure sap thrust halts the coastline of our so-called sea-girt isle, so habitable province, serving up its ultimate smile. The small green plant in the wound on your wrist became the lens through which I saw how air could pierce the ground, how black clouds fattening were slave joys you rejected, flight-cramped child, hollowed into airworthy place. Your lingering future is less meditated necessary than to sail this eve of battle, national holiday sky. I know we paid a visit to Cyprus, away from it all type of thing, and found we were right back in it. And there was nothing but British British soldiers about the place. So it was home from home. And so this is a poem about Cyprus. And there were nothing. Again, they had a really terrible war there. And a lot of cemeteries just full of people and who died during their tragic war, which is much worse than anything we had. So fearing a Cypriot experience, I wrote this. It's called Timed Chess, and it's addressed to Cyprus. You break the darkness like an apple, making fingers of lips and lips of fingers. You twist leathered wrists into hands, fold mortal messages in the slow closing of both eyes till only the face counts. Sometimes, like an old of the coast, following in cloud pieces the shapes of Italian clouds, you send a strange perfume in your stead, indubitably male, a carnation passed through a buttonhole. No journey is more safely beautiful than all the miles of you, your many degrees of death lying almost a lifetime in the distance. When the sky turns frail over your many-lobed harbour, your sea quality opens fresh petals. Your hedges hesitate to change, keeping their beard like an overhanging war or a slightly cowardly peace. Your sun-hungry end of winter colours incompletely shed the enemy world. The denier of my sleep, woman or ghost, is a full river. Looted wines in large throatfuls flavour the tight air. All the land is behind, the unworked were repeating the her and the her. And I wrote these sort of love poems, which are meant to really be about the Catholics and the Protestants, which it always amazes me that we're interpreted as being enemies. We're crazy about each other. We even marry each other. And it's ludicrous to think that it's anything to do with not getting on, because we get on fine. So this is a poem about how fine we get on. We even apologize when we kill each other. The colony room. If you are touching, you are also being touched. If I place my hands in prayer, palm to palm, I give your hands new meaning, your left hand calm. You define my body, center of your hand. I hear through the shingled roof of your skin, your ear-shaped body enter the curved floor line of my skin. My hands just skim the cushioned opening, the glitter of your mouth. All woods, roots, and flowers scent and stretch the map that covers your body. Less touchable than the birth or continuation of Ireland in its railed enclosure, your root note in its sexual climate, your kingdom come eyes, year-long inactive lover, durable as paradise. Like small shocks in the winter, neck to neck, the mirrors reflected the colored ray the evenings needed most when the day asked for night in that mistletoe way. And just a couple more of these, and then I'm going to finish with a love poem. So I'm surprised that I can read a love poem, but I feel like reading a love poem for some reason. This is called The Sickness of the Cloth. Summer is your worst hour. When everything has turned completely golden, you will recover your blue transparent sky. When the gardens of evening begin to suffer, your olive-clothed hillsides will taste of honey and dawn. Now it rains even though God doesn't want it to. A phantom river feeds the cowed, impoverished city. We see in looking from squares the souls of all who used to cross them. Crosses look like missiles, the rose-colored blotches of feeble Republican bombings embroider a liberal flag. where the unsurfaced road loops sharply, a sea of fruit and dark flesh made for the moon is born. Its silence deadens contrary musics, but its tongue is luminous. From November to November, the nights of reeds in shadow exchange sunflowers. The moons of that place are beautiful as Joseph, and thousands of winged insects spread myrtle there, each living cell thawed by the last still bearing warmth. This is a poem I wrote about all the political prisoners, and it also relates to poets as well, who are outside of the normal. So I felt that, you know, in a way I was at least they were hopefully getting out of prison, and I was always going to be in one as a poet. So it's really about poets and about political prisoners. So it's called The Spirit Dolls. They subtract us as matter from their lives. Spice merchants, tanners, coopers, weavers, wine merchants, innkeepers, florists, casual mercenaries. They made themselves up as they went along. Outsiders, as a new us and an old them, in the scoured pot of our acid, indigestible, please and thank you army. And now, from their eerie inland sea, from waterhouse or drowning cell, a species of anti-workers, anti-bodies, professional loiterers, ne'er-do-wells, emerge corrected by clandestine truce, like the reputed male Semper Augustus, red flames on white, to avoid turning out as a nation, turning into a state. And this is the last one on this, and then I'll read the love poem. Hopefully it is a love poem. Not always sure if it is or not. So this is a war poem, and then it's called Condition 3, which it was the last poem I wrote before the ceasefire. And it was about the state that I'm in all the time, but the rest of the country we're also in, where you feel people are sitting with their hands on buttons and everything could just blow up any minute. Okay. Condition 3. Dawn that I always thought of as fixed, the most closed country, embers more often. Brokerous womb mosaics a breadth of dusk, an overnight autumn. Some deep, unsweetened, sour-smelling ingredient elbows out the time-related twittering of birds, night crests walking against pillows, so that I miss their never-denied noise, like the largely unheard sounds of war, the colour of war, and find myself wishing I were a weather-whipped rocket walking into news of any kind. An unreal warship sculpts the coast with its watchful, eloquent English, its cool, watered path from a mid-century midwinter to a clockless marriage summer has frozen all time but its own. It has probably hurt someone I knew, or there is some hurt beginning to happen, its slow bleed bringing eyes down into pages, mouths down to the onion-thin sheets of paper butterflied, ebonied by the bombs. Its aloneness corners onto mine, is quilted on like land. It spreads open my worn days by the dayful, all its seamless miles. I am listening in black and white to what speaks to me in blue, in that peacock power of voice whose vistas furnish the house, till the night, an enchanted day, overwhelms any man-made light. When there is a distance to it or a fast from the incense of talk, it's wound in other voices, in mouths sewn in protest, in arms crossed behind necks and eyes which are almost too calm. A sudden set of mid-sentence years will be served like home hours, or the last time your bare lips on certain shrines were used. and this one is it's called The Keeper Ring. And a keeper ring is a ring that keeps other rings on, and sometimes very necessary item in your wardrobe. If you look at Irish short stories, a lot of the males write these very sentimental stories about women losing their rings. And this is my effort in that direction. So it's about domestic love, which is probably the nicest kind. Maybe it's the only kind. Okay, so it's called The Keeper Ring. My eyes change in the direction of the gentlest brown. Yours are all the shapes that the blackbird's egg shows. The rain is an open display on the emptiness of my lips. Sweet because odorless, it muzzles into everything. The roads between us are ill-lit. The traffic islands, telephone kiosks, the cruising areas have less reality than the equator, like a face suggesting movement no less than a bird's wings. Yours is a side of life I have not lain on, though once I leaned out of bed and stretched my arm to within an inch of the base of your sleeping throat, as if willing you to wake. This dark house we had planned to leave carries a single letter on its back, the floor raying out in lozenge greens and two pairs of leaves, as though in its world there were no autumn. The hollyhocks decapitated swim in a basin chased with four birds. Each tress on the mantelpiece fringe is plaited into four strands, at the end of each a little golden ball. You fold your napkin into the packed muscles of a millefeuille. I stir mine into the French grey lining of my cup, till it is reborn in the blue embroidered saucer of its nest. The house dreams in the skip of my sentence, flame-coloured now, Italian-walled, though the snow-fed light passes one tree only. Okay, thank you.